Okay, good evening. Welcome to this, fifth meeting of the Expanded Budget Committee in 2021. It is September 30th. We have a packed agenda tonight with all our human services agencies, and we're going to kick that one off with Kathy Schlother and John Mazzello. Telling us about the Human Services Coalition and the agencies it supports. So take it away.
Hi, folks. It's nice to kind of see most of you.
We're having to learn people's voices without a lot of visual. John and I are here, and just to guard against any Zoom or internet crinkles, John and I are actually in two separate places. So if one of us goes out, the other one should be able to continue. So,
suspenders.
We're going to start, John's going to start by talking about the agencies that we represent.
Well, hello and good afternoon, everyone. And thanks again for the opportunity to speak with you. It's one of the highlights of my year, for sure. And especially want to thank you for the trust that you place in the Human Services Coalition for making recommendations to you all for funding for human service agencies in the community agencies budget line. In the interest of time, we're going to go relatively quickly through the recommendations and our requests, focusing mostly on the changes and over target requests. So you can see here the overall recommended budgets. I will say that I shared with Autumn the documents that you as the legislature have often appreciated from us in the past, including the quick cheat sheet, if you will, of the agencies that apply for funding.
She forwarded those to us, John.
She did. Okay, great. That's excellent. I'm glad. Also includes the chart of our recommendations and Lisa's recommendations and some additional detail, and then also just some charts of the historic funding over the last 10 years or so for the different agencies. So I know those are things that have been useful for you in the past, and we're glad to provide those to you. So just as a quick recap, these are the agencies that have applied for funding through HSC's review process this year. And just to give you a sense of how the process works, we began all the way back in April with applications from agencies. We have, a fairly exhaustive review process talking with them. We've got a citizens review committee that really helps to make the decision process that then goes to the Human Services Coalition Board and is shared with Lisa. But we have the opportunity for the director of every program who applies and a board member or more to meet with our group. They can discuss the challenges they're having, the successes they're seeing, their particular requests each year. And that application process includes both a programmatic review as well as a fairly detailed financial review of the organizations. I did want to point out that, it's kind of arcane, but the city of Ithaca does contribute to the community agencies line through a longstanding agreement with the county. And the share that comes from the city is based on the previous year's tax receipts, tax collections. So for 2022, the city's share is actually based on the tax collections from 2020. And as we know, the tax collections were down significantly in 2020. So the city's share of support is reduced by almost 16% for next year. I will share with you, though, that we have requested that the city consider using some of their ARP funding to help mitigate this decline. So we certainly aren't expecting the county to cover the full freight, but we do have that request in with the city, and we're hopeful that they will consider that as well. There are just a lot of influences this year that have affected the agencies, and I know that you often have asked lots of questions around how are the agencies doing and what's going on with them. And so we wanted to give you a little bit of the story here in a few minutes. So first, there's new directors at 7 of the 19 agencies that applied this year. That's more than a third and really quite high for our group in any given year. So lots of change, lots of turnover. Certainly there's always board member turnover, but to have seven new directors is pretty significant. And we've seen retirements, people leaving the area, lots of reasons why. Just like for the county, the impacts of COVID-19 continue in many different ways, and here are a few of them. Agencies have moved to a mix of in-person and remote operations. Really, everything I'm going to tell you now is a mixed bag. It really does vary across the agencies. But some organizations have gone back to fully in-person. They were closed really very briefly and reopened almost immediately last year. Others are still in a more remote kind of operation with their offices perhaps closed or closed to visitors but open to staff. And part of that is due to, you know, health concerns and the decisions that the organization made, but also some due to the demand for in-person or remote services from their clientele. So some organizations are working with people who really need and prefer that in-person type of support. And other organizations are seeing the demand for their in-person support decline and really a demand for that remote assistance and remote work continuing. So organizations have really been striving to address the needs of their constituency while being safe, but also seeing that there's this kind of mix across the organizations, both in what they're doing and what their clientele is demanding of them. We are seeing client needs change and deepen in many ways. For example, these are just some examples that I thought were interesting, that might be interesting to you. Seeking different kinds of financial assistance, particularly households that have not had to seek help before, that have not had to ask for assistance of a nonprofit or sign up for some kind of benefit program in the past, and really needing some kind of more flexible assistance, like can't afford to pay this bill, or I can't get my car repaired, but I need it to get to work, or I can't cover the, you know, last year, the internet, so my kid could do virtual school, things like that. So we're seeing needs that really hadn't been present before and continue to bubble up. We're seeing many more bills in arrears. Obviously, hearing about rental assistance type programs has been in the news and very prominent lately, but other bills as well, utilities, and other kinds of expenses that people have had to prioritize one over another and haven't been able to keep current on all of the bills that they've had, whether it's because of a loss of a job, a COVID-related loss of income, inability to work while caring for family members, things like that. And we've really seen organizations really striving to meet clients where they are, to provide services in different ways, to change their services, to try to address some of these different needs, to start doing food distributions, even if they're not a food provider, to start providing different kinds of things that really will meet the needs of their clientele. So it's been both a time of lots of successes in the sense that these organizations are really working hard to meet the needs of the community, but also a time of challenges because these are more demands that have been placed on organizations and the community at the same time. And then finally, we're seeing kind of, again, a mixed bag around filling open positions at organizations. In general, applicant pools are down. The numbers of applicants are low, or the number of qualified applicants are relatively low. I had a couple organizations mention to me that they felt like they were lucky in being able to find qualified candidates when they've run searches, but it was that feeling of luck, not that they felt like there was a fait accompli that they would have good candidates, but they really felt like they were lucky. So that's been a concern and continues to be a concern for most organizations that we're working with. And similarly, volunteer numbers are also down as volunteers who may be people who are, you know, who are retired, maybe people who have other things that they're focusing on. They may be people who are not interested in necessarily coming out and spending a lot of time with these organizations when they are still concerned for their health or their own family's health. So we have seen with many organizations, the volunteer pools have also drastically shrunk. There are a lot smaller and a lot fewer people who are interested in keeping up the same level of volunteerism that they had previously. So for the paid positions as well as those unpaid positions, we're seeing some challenges. pretty significant challenges almost across the board. So I'll quickly go through the over-target requests, and we do appreciate that Lisa has recommended most of our requests either through the one-time ARP funds or as target OTRs. Most of these, I think, will be familiar to you. They are programs that have been supported in the past, but I will highlight a few of them. So the first is the Law New York Reentry Program. This is one that has supported individuals who are returning to the community from incarceration. And this helps them with reducing the barriers to their employment and helping them with other needs. That one is recommended and has been in the past. That's one time. There are two recommendations that we have described as the community agency's target request, and then there's also a one-time recommendation for a community agency's distribution. And this is a little confusing, and I just want to take a moment to explain it here. So we spent a lot of time talking with Lisa and with Kevin before he left earlier this summer. There's a good mechanism for cutting all the different agencies, but not a great mechanism for trying to increase the number without doing a whole lot of OTRs for you to consider. So our solution here was to make a single, or in this case two actually, but make a single over target request, which we're calling the community agency's target request, and lump a proportional percentage increase to the participating agencies based on the other target funding that they're receiving as a way to try to bolster the funding that they're receiving. So that's where that community agency's target request is really putting all that increase in one OTR rather than asking you for 19 to consider. So that's recommended as target. And then there is also an over target request, that is in the one time. And that was number 51. Sorry. And what we are considering with that one is, to have a pool that HSC's review committee can use to be a little bit more flexible next year to meet changing needs, especially as we, you know, hopefully begin to emerge from the pandemic and see that there are areas that could use a little bit of extra assistance. And so that's a $20,000 one-time request that has, that should say one-time ARPA, not, I'm sorry, I missed something here. But the target ARPAs should, of course, be one-time ARPAs. Okay, so in addition, there's a couple other funded OTRs, the Tompkins County Food Distribution Network Pantry Expansion. That's one where the funding that goes through this process is used for a line of credit with the Food Bank of the Southern Tier. They are expanding to three additional pantries, one at Ithaca College, one at the Ithaca Free Clinic, and in progress, one at TC3. So rather than keep their amount the same and reduce the food availability for each of the existing 15, we requested some additional funds for the new ones. There's also recommendations for some OAR, OTRs. One is for Core Services, one is for Endeavor House Case Management. We've got an OTR that's supporting the St. John's Community Services Friendship Center, and also one that has been a program that you have supported for several years in one-time requests and now has moved into the target pool, and that's the College Initiative Upstate that works with OAR clients and others who had been incarcerated or are currently incarcerated in really furthering their education. And then finally, in the recommended OTRs, the OAR's Parolee Housing Case Manager, who works with individuals who are living in OAR housing and really helping them to meet their needs that can be addressed through that program. So finally, I will wrap up now by talking just about two of the OTRs that were not recommended to be funded in the county administrator's recommended budget. The first is the Child Development Council's Building Access to Childcare. This is one of our agencies with a new director. Melissa Perry has taken over for longtime executive director Sue Dale Hall. And this was previously a three-year OTR supporting a pilot around helping to build the business case and the business kind of back office supports for childcare providers, particularly programs that are home-based, such as family daycare and group family daycare providers. So not those big centers, but those in-home programs. Over the course of the 3 years of their project, they learned several lessons, right? First, that childcare is essential and that the pandemic has really focused on the need for childcare. The individual attention working with these potential providers and existing providers really strengthened their ability to be able to succeed and thrive. Starting a childcare program in the home is no small undertaking, and the supports that they were able to provide to give to these providers really made a difference in helping them to be successful. And finally, there are business supports that can help make these programs more sustainable. Things like reducing their administrative burden by streamlining their hiring and payroll type services, as well as working together to assist with training and other needs so that each program doesn't have to go it alone. So their next step with this program is really to expand throughout the county, to focus on those additional business supports again, as I mentioned, and also help them to be able to seek other funding and to build on the gains made during the pilot. The second OTR that was not recommended was Law New York's Early Intervention Homeless Prevention Program. And this is one, again, that the legislature has supported in the past through OTRs. This is a program that supports individuals who really need significant case management and other assistance to meet their housing needs, particularly as they are in a situation where they are in eviction proceedings or at risk of moving into eviction proceedings. Now, we know that there have been a number of eviction moratorium orders that have come and gone and come again. And we know that there is a big exponential expected increase of evictions and other actions already starting, in fact, against some of these tenants who are at most risk. So this program provides support through two paralegals and staff attorneys to develop a strong relationship with the client. Again, these are clients who have pretty significant needs. And those paralegals serve as the common thread, that relationship, that strong relationship, even if it moves into a court setting. There's lots of different needs that are supported through this program, but particularly physical and mental health needs, rental arrears, repairs, and of course, difficult relationships between tenants and landlords. This program has served 28 households so far this year. None have become homeless, and all are either still in their original housing or new permanent housing. And finally, I will add that this is another program where we have a new executive director, a new director for the program. Keith McCafferty has taken over from Greg Thomas as the managing attorney for Law New York here in Tompkins County. And Law New York has made a commitment to supplementing county funds for this program with funds from other sources because they really do believe in the importance of the work that they're doing here around homelessness prevention. So with that, we're happy to answer any questions. And otherwise, I will turn it over to Kathy.
Okay. We'll just keep going now, and then we can take questions when we're through with the whole thing. And now we're shifting over to the Human Service Coalition itself. Okay. John's actually running the slide, so I'll just say next. All right. This is a recommended budget. It is the same budget that we had last year. I did put a little note down because I couldn't help myself saying that we usually get a historic 2% increase. Our budget now is about $70,000 less than where we would be without the pandemic adjustments that have happened. Okay. We made two over-target requests, one for $60,000 for a data specialist and one $30,000 request for a Human Services Coalition housing specialist. If we go to the next slide, I'll explain a little about them. So we have been and are continuing to be kind of drowning in our need to come up with data and reports for various programs. Our homeless management information system continues to grow and every year kind of burdens with data. The 211 data is increasing a lot. We had stopped, but would like to continue to provide some community-wide health trends data that agencies could use. And we also know part of having seven new directors is we really need somebody who can work with the agency to help set and track their goals. In addition to that, we would love to do, instead of contracting out some of the surveys like the salary and benefits survey, which is due to be redone this year, which is going to be really interesting because along with food, I'm really curious to see there's been a big increase in food, but I'm really curious to see how salaries have had to adjust to this kind of lack of workforce and what kind of adjustment people have been able to do. So that was recommended as one-time ARP funding. And the second is a part-time position for a part-time person to help with our housing programs, our continuum of care and other programs, someone who can help manage the coordinated entry process and assist with all the competition and projects around the COC. And that was also recommended with one-time ARP funding. So I just wanted to talk a little bit, kind of my last slide, about our major influences that we've been dealing with this past year. A lot of them related to COVID. We put a little graph in on the side that shows the contacts, the calls that 211 have been taking have gone up 100% before pre-COVID time. We used to take about 12,000 a year. We are on track to look to take about 26 to 27,000 calls this year. There are calls around transportation, food, emergency relief. We do have the United Way ALICE program fund that will give up to $500 for certain kind of expenses that can't be covered in any of the other programs. And we continue to talk to people about the vaccination calls. Now, of course, we're talking about the booster calls and all the other calls that come in around health insurance. Excuse me. Our housing department has really grown this past year. Here are some of the programs that we've taken on just this year. We're doing the ERAP program, helping people sign up for ERAP and the rental assistance program. Housing stability support program, which is funding that's going to about 50 different residents for rental arrears support. We are about to launch. We are going to be administrating the Mayor's Guaranteed Income Project, which also is cash that will go to about 100 different people throughout the county. We are now have been offered, and these are things that might have been done up, but the HUD is now requiring that the COC actually administer these housing vouchers. There's really nice housing vouchers that pay things like moving and repairs and up to 110% of above what the market rate is, or 10% above what market rate is. And they were given to New York State, and we keep sending in names for these special vouchers that are out there in New York State. And the last project, which we just got told about a week ago, was the Youth Homeless Demonstration Project. That is about $2 million for homeless youth programs. So we are administrating, these are all programs we're administering that we were not last year. The other thing we're doing, a lot of consulting with agencies around everything from how do they make new plans, how do they do work differently, how do they get volunteers, how do they get new board members, doing a lot of leadership development with the new directors and the new directors that will be coming on. So those are kind of the things that have kept us really very busy this past year. So I think that is it. If there are any questions or anything we can do to answer any questions for anybody.
I have a question from Shauna.
Hi, Shauna.
Hi, thank you very much for the presentation. I just wanted to let my colleagues know that I will be submitting an OTR for the daycare council or the child development council for the OTR. It's been in place for 3 years now. And the position has actually changed over the course of 1 to 2 years. And so I'm going to work with Melissa next week, and I'll be submitting that OTR for my colleagues to vote on to keep that position. I did have a question, a few questions, actually. I'm a little bit concerned that the city is decreasing their amount by 16%. Because if anything, right now is really not the time to decrease your funding to your human services groups. And so that's concerning. I was wondering if they are going to provide any ARPA funding to fill in that gap.
Right. That is the decrease was just due to the decrease in SILPA, that very complicated formula that gets the money from the city, like the little percent of the percent into the county portion. We did ask them to make up that difference with their ARP funding. I don't think they're as far along with that funding process as you guys are. So when we talked to the mayor and Deb Mollenhoff, who is our liaison, they thought that certainly sounded like something that they would be able to do. But I don't think it's been voted on yet.
Okay. And then I did have a question about the Law New York position. And I know that we have allocated quite a bit of money to Law New York to supplement evictions in the moratorium, and just wanted to see, I know that right now they haven't been able to move forward with evictions. And wondering if the money that they've been supplemented so far has been able to accommodate, and if it will be able to accommodate in the upcoming year.
So we did ask both Melissa and Keith McCafferty to be here. Is it all right if I ask, we ask Keith to answer that question?
Hi, Keith.
Hi, Shauna. Thanks for the question. Despite the moratoriums, there have actually been evictions going on. There are exceptions to the moratoriums that if landlords and their attorneys are getting better at utilizing. And there are also what people are calling soft evictions, which is landlords harassing people into leaving in certain cases. So our attorneys have actually been pretty busy with those cases. In terms of the emergency, the early intervention homelessness project, I know, so I'm sort of new to this, so I'm still learning, but we were unable to spend all the money in 2020, so some of that was carried over into 2021, and we had a smaller allocation in 2021, $20,000 with a $20,000 carryover from the year before. That money will easily, surely be, I'm sure it's already spent this year. We have two fairly experienced folks who are doing this work now and are spending lots and lots of time with our clients. And the benefit of this program really is that developing that relationship with the client, so we can really dig deep into the other issues that are related to them being suddenly at risk of homelessness and trying to resolve those issues so that we can get them into a steady state. So we're expecting, as we look forward to 2022, an increase in evictions, which is going to make our attorneys much busier. And then having this program to sort of reduce some of those evictions by resolving them ahead of time, and also helping the attorneys get to know the clients, which we wouldn't be able to do. We want to get closer to a place where all tenants in all eviction proceedings can get representation. So the more that we can, you know, get some supplements that help us with the paralegals that can help avoid some of these evictions, the closer we can get to that sort of right to counsel place, if that answers the question.
Yeah, yeah. And then my other question is, I know that there has been a very difficult time recruiting paralegals because your salaries tend to be a bit low in that area. And whenever you get a good one, they tend to move on. And I was wondering, is this something that perhaps we or someone else can contribute more and that could go directly towards obtaining really good paralegals that are going to stay there for a while and help your agency?
So great question. And I think just actually yesterday we had made an announcement that is going to address some of this. So when we've hired paralegals in the past, we have not given them credit for their long maybe work experience history. It's we've given them credit for work experience that's more directly related to advocacy work. So we've changed that effective October 1st and will now give people a lot more credit in the hiring process. So they'll start further up on the salary scale.
That's
so
great.
The two folks we hired this year have extensive experience, not as paralegals. And so they're being paid at a higher rate, which will help us retain them.
That's
we're also paying almost 100% of people's healthcare premiums. So that is also going to help.
Okay. Well, if it needs to go forth as an OTR, I am happy to bring that forth. I think this is a really good program, and it's helped a lot of people. So I am certainly happy to bring that forth, and I hope my colleagues will join me. And then I did have another question in regards to the new positions that have been proposed for the Human Services Coalition. Can you tell me, are those going to be just a one-year position, or are they going to be a multi-year position?
They were requested as target positions, but they were recommended as one-time, or they're not even multi-year one-time, which I think they're just one-time. I'm not sure how that works anymore.
Okay. Yeah, we might want to change that just because it's so hard to recruit people just for 1 year. So I'll talk to Lisa and we'll figure it out.
It's meant to be multi-year. I'm sorry that it wasn't notated as such.
Okay, great. Thank you.
But it says in the book that you're using ARPA funds. So how are we using ARPA funds for a long-term position?
Well, my plan was to use ARPA funds wherever we could this year for one time, and then for next year, whatever we have available to continue. You know, if there are ARPA funds remaining next year or fund balance, or if we can fit them into the target.
Okay. All right. I have Amanda and then Martha.
Thank you for your presentation. I had a couple of questions too, but I can maybe talk to Melissa and Shauna later about that one OTR and just getting some more information on that. But I did want to ask John about OTR 50. The community agency's target request. I was just wondering how did you determine how you split all those up and who got what amount?
Yeah, good question. So let me just pull up here. Number 50. So number 50 is really, I would say, based on the work that our review committee does throughout the whole process. So what we essentially did was I think you would be very impressed at how carefully this group takes their responsibility to recommend taxpayer money. And so what we did was the group went through and made recommendations based on they made recommendations based on what they believed were the appropriate allocations for each agency as part of the process, based on the requests from the agencies, based on community need, and based on the meetings and conversations with the applicants. Then we also took into consideration the target amount that was available, the total target, which was $36,150 less than what the recommendations were. And so what we did was we proportionately carved out that amount, stuck that difference in as an OTR, and then we'll proportionately allocate that money to the agencies based on the request, the total breakdown of the recommendations. So basically that one will not need to be any real decision making happening there. It will just proportionally go in the same proportions as the recommendations in the target pool. On the other hand, the OTR 51, the next one there, that one we will rely on our review our Citizens Review Committee to assist with making recommendations during the course of 2022 on how to use that funding, depending on what are the needs in the community, what are we seeing around you know, COVID needs or reopening and reemerging type needs. I do want to point out that, and I put this in the PIA or in the OTR request, while the Human Services Coalition does have a contingency fund that the county has previously supported for kind of emergency needs, our intention with this is to use that entire pot of funding next year to support emerging needs. So that's not something that we're planning to sit on at all.
Okay, that makes sense. And then one last question about that OTR 50. There's a note at the bottom that OAR funding is separate and then Child Development Council is recommended only as one time. Why is that?
Can you ask that again?
Just about your note at the bottom of that OTR, particularly why is the Child Development Council recommended only as one time?
Oh, yeah. Okay. So the Child Development Council, the review committee felt like because this was a program that was moving out of a pilot phase, that they felt like the most appropriate recommendation was to recommend it as a one time to see the direction that it was going, and then you know, potentially return in subsequent years with a target request. But because it was changing, exiting out of that pilot phase and reconfiguring as Shauna has mentioned and others, really felt like it was appropriate to put in as a one time, to keep it in the one time, just until we had a little bit more clarity on the direction of that program.
Okay. Okay, thank you.
Okay, thank you. Martha.
Thank you, Deborah, and thank you, John and Kathy. So much information. So if I can understand back to number 50, is this trying to get those agencies back up to where they would have been without, you know, if they'd been on that trajectory of 2% increases over the last 2 years?
Yeah, good question, Martha. So we had initially put in the 36,150, number 50 there, and number 51 as target requests. With both of those together would be where, if you just took the county's share back in 2019 and kept bumping it up 2% until next year, between the two of those, that would be where we would have been hypothetically.
Got it. Okay. So Lisa, you're, when you've, I guess this is a big question about the one-time funding. Are you, I mean, for our things that are funded with ARPA, you've got next year also. I assume, am I to understand that what you've put into this whole big book adds up to the first, you know, 9.8 million or something, and not the 20 million?
Meaning the first tranche of ARPA?
Right.
Yes, we will be getting the second tranche in May of next year. So yes, I mean, I don't think that we will be in any danger of having overspent by May.
Okay, I guess my question is, were you looking at the ARPA funding as a $20 million bucket or a $10 million bucket for this budget?
I was looking at it as a $20 million bucket in terms of the capital program, which is roughly $15 million, and then roughly $5 million for other purposes.
Okay. I guess at some point maybe we should – I'd love to understand the cash flow piece of that, and I don't know if it's possible kind of to see a comprehensive list of all the ARPA designations that you've got in here. It's a long list, I know, but that if that's possible, that would be helpful to understand better. So there's that. when you went into your, John and Kathy went into your age, into the coalition as an agency budget, you said that you are $70,000 less than that trajectory. So you have asked for money to make the agencies whole, and that's that $36,000, but you haven't asked for the funding to make the coalition whole itself, correct?
That is correct. We did not do that this year, thinking that that wasn't supposed to be done.
Okay. All right. Thank you. And then if there, I don't know if Deb Dietrich is on here. I'm looking. A question about the two OAR proposals. That's Endeavor House number 53 and 54 for parolee housing case manager. Is Deb here?
I don't believe she is.
No, Deb is not here tonight.
Okay. I guess I was, if I understand the way this is written, if you can't answer, I'll follow up with her. So the first one for $20,000 is for Endeavor House, and the second one for $50,000 is for the new Sunflower Houses. Is that right? Do you know?
Sorry.
For the parolee houses.
53, and what's the other one?
54, I think.
OTR 54 is titled Parolee Housing Case Manager. I think that's for,
those are different positions. The Parolee House Case Manager is an in-OAR staff person that just tries to house people coming into their system and does some case management work for them, you know, try to get them employed and stuff. The other one is actually for somebody who works in Endeavor House and, would also work with, I'm sorry, what's it called again? Sunflower House, that would work, with the people who are just living in those houses who are already. Yeah, house and that's house.
Right. I think one of the hiccups here is that in the middle of that paragraph, it's on our page 18, OAR is exploring additional housing options for parolees with URO and INHS. And since this book was put together, since their proposal went in, they have firmed up that collaboration. And then so we've had more presentations at committee. So
right. That's exactly right.
Got it. That's what's going to. Okay. They're not the same thing. All right. Appreciate it. Thank you very, very much.
Thank you. Leslie?
So I have a question for, it's probably for Melissa from Child Development Council and the OTR that was not funded. This is just because I want to spend the state's money. Because it's not often that the state gives us lots of money. And so it's just a question because I don't know what all the parameters are. The amount of money that the state set aside for childcare last year, there were lots of various uses. Is this something that we could get some of that money for? And then we can redirect our funding for something else that you might need.
That's a great question. So we are looking to leverage this funding too in order to, expand on our reach to the child care providers. So yes, there's tons of funding coming down right now, to support child care. There's really nothing, there is funding specifically for business supports, but there are rigid requirements in order to be eligible for that funding, and not everybody meets that. So there are definitely providers who are falling through the cracks who are not eligible to get that support, where in this case, if we had this funding, we would be able to support them with recruitment and business support. So then we can relieve those stressors for them, and they can focus on providing that quality care to the children.
I guess my question, if I may just ask a follow-up, is that money that the Child Development Council can access, not the individual child care providers, to do exactly what you're talking about and what you're asking to do and use up, you know, like you said, tons of money that's coming from the state.
Right. Sure.
So that really is my question.
Yeah. Okay. So the child care providers are able to access those funds, and we are facilitating that connection to support providers who are eligible, but not, again, not all providers are eligible. It depends of, you know, when they were open during the pandemic, where they are in their licensure processing. So there are still that some that are falling through the cracks.
Thank you.
You're welcome.
Okay, is there anything else for the HSC folks? Lisa, is your hand up?
Yeah, I just wanted to just make one comment that my reasoning for why these two OTRs weren't recommended from Child Development Council in Law New York was simply because the county had funded them. There were 3-year OTRs, and we finished the 3 years. So I wanted to leave it to the legislature's discretion as to whether to continue or not. That's all.
I appreciate that. I personally would like to see some hard data on how successful these programs were, actually. Leslyn, you have your hand up again, or is that just a yellow splotch up in the corner?
I don't have old hands. That is my new bright yellow hand.
Okay.
In a similar vein, I'm interested, and I know Deb is not on here, in hearing some more about Endeavor House and how that has been working. I know we funded the case manager, I don't know, 2019 budget or something like that. I can't remember. Because they saw the need. And I'm interested in hearing a little bit more. I don't know if Kathy or John, you know, in your review, got any information about how that's going, especially when I'm hearing about the potential for, you know, additional housing. And I'm not sure, maybe they've reported to public safety or HHS about how it's going. I don't know. So I'd be interested in more information on the success of Endeavor House, and making sure that we're really shoring that up to do what it was designed to do before we go branching out further. So any information would be great. Thanks.
That's a good point, Leslyn. And I think that the Human Services Coalition and OIR can certainly provide that to all of us in written form. Okay, so are we ready to move on? Because for the first time in this process, we are behind schedule. All right. Thank you, Kathy. Thank you, John. Thank you.
Thank you very much. And
thank you.
Sorry for putting you behind schedule.
Have a great evening, everyone.
Thanks.
Okay. You too. So we have Lisa Monroe from the County Office for the Aging. Take it away, Lisa.
Hi, everybody. I hope to get you back on track because I don't think I'm going to take long. So can you see my screen?
Yes, ma'am.
Okay, let me get it. Yes, so I also wanted to just, well, say thank you, first of all, but also introduce Karen Bullis is here with me, our deputy, and Bob Slocum should be on here too, our fiscal coordinator. Welcome them both here. I'm trying to get my slideshow bigger. Is that large now? Do you see that?
Yes, it's perfect, Lisa. Thank you.
Great. I want to thank them for being here with me too and working on the budget with me and, you know, keeping our programs running for the last year and a half. And I did want to shout out Karen a little bit because not only while she was working here as a deputy, but she spent a lot of time with the health department helping with contact tracing and the vaccine response and doing her job here with us too. So I appreciate that. I have a great team. And like I said, I'll keep this brief and try to give you a few minutes back. So, okay, I'll go right to the recommended budget. We, you know, our budget is within target, so we are not asking for any over target requests. You'll see that the percent changes you see in the 2022 budget is really because our 2021 budget was modified. We were fortunate to receive some funding from the CARES and FCRA Act, and the revenues and the expenditures directly relate to that, why that change looks like that. We also, this year, are receiving some ARPA funds. So that is coming to us this year directly through NYSOFA, and that will also be carried into 2022, and it's part of the reason why our FTEs are being increased. You see, we'll have a 5.8% increase, which is going to give us a part-time 21-hour position for an info aide. So there's that. This slide right here is super busy. I'll try to sum it up for you a little bit. I'm trying to get the boxes out of my way here of everybody. So you see, what I really want to highlight here is just how our services are broken up into pieces. You can see that the New York Connects program is 100% state funded. It's 90% of our budget. Our nutrition services are 35% of our budget, but 41% of that is locally funded. Our home care services is 17% of the budget. That is 37% locally funded. And all our other programs and administration, 39% of the budget, and 40% of that is locally funded. We'll continue to administer our 30 contracts. We have 12 subcontractors, 22 different funding streams, and really some of the highlights, because we're not really doing anything completely different or asking for any OTRs, we'll continue to shift our funding into some of our home care services. We have to shift because of the needs that are changing and the lack of home health care aides in the community. We can continue some of our programming, our social isolation programming, which particularly our Senior Planet tablet project program, which basically provides technology and a connection for eligible clients to teach them basic computer skills, to try to get them into the virtual world, and also provides them a friendly visitor along with a hotline, like a 1-800 hotline, tech hotline they can call anytime. We just recently received a mini grant from a Lifespan for respite, to provide respite to caregivers of loved ones with Parkinson's disease. We'll be starting that this year, but that will be carried into 2022 as well. So that's really all I have for you. And welcome any questions.
All right. Mike Lane has a question.
Sure. Actually, I have two. Hi, Lisa.
Hi.
I wondered how the funding for HEAP is going to be this winter, particularly with the Old Farmer's Almanac, they said, telling us we're going to have a very cold winter here.
I've heard that, too. And Kit might be able to answer this better than I. Actually, HEAP season opens tomorrow, which is early. Typically, it opens a little bit later. The early mail-outs have gone out already, and we've been busy here collecting applications, and we'll probably be very busy tomorrow as well. I hope it holds out. I haven't heard anything either way. Again, Kit might know a little bit more than I do about that.
Okay. The other question I had is home health care workers has always been a problem. How's it looking out there now? Is it a lot worse?
Unfortunately, yeah, it really is. It's a struggle. Actually, the Human Services Coalition has a task force with a bunch of people that have come to the table to try to work on it and find some solutions. But through COVID, it has only gotten worse, really.
Are there people out there that aren't able to get the home health care workers that need them?
There is, yeah, we do have a short waiting list in our office. Again, some of the funding that we have is, we call it unmet needs funding, and that has increased, and we're trying to find other solutions to help people to stay in their homes that aren't necessarily the aides themselves. For example, somebody might just need some housekeeping or somebody to cook them a meal or some laundry services. We're trying to find like alternate assistance to keep homes because the aides just aren't there. We just can't find them. And the agencies that we contract with are just saying the same thing.
Okay. Not good to hear, but thank you.
No. Yes. Thank you. You're welcome.
Thanks, Lisa. Leslie?
Thank you. Thank you, Lisa. Thank you, Karen. Thank you, Bob. Mike asked one of my questions about the home health care workers. and if we're seeing the same shortage. So thank you for answering that already. My other two questions have to do with just getting a little update on the evolution of the North Southside program, that multicultural program. What is it looking like these days? And, you know, sort of the numbers of people, particularly people of color who we're serving in that program. And then the second question has to do with the home repairs program. Understanding just a little bit more about eligibility guidelines, as I'm aware so many seniors have sort of fall through the cracks, and I'm just wondering a little bit more about that.
Sure. I'll start with the Northside Southside program, which is now being called the Mosaic program. We finally have come up with some kind of name that Lifelong has named it. We're still supporting them with funding to do this. This year is really kind of I'll call it a working year to determine what we really want to do with it. They're trying to work on getting surveys. I know that they're actually working with Zach at GIAC to just determine what do we want this to look like and encompass more than just historically African Americans. So it used to be that our Lifelong still has, and a lot of this has changed through COVID, but it's starting back up again. There's an older adult Asian American group that meets there. There's an LGBT group that meets there. So we're trying to bring like unique programming that kind of cuts across different sectors, you know. So it's a work in progress. Liza and I and Karen have met several times about that, and they're working on it. They're putting the feelers out, having like small group sessions with people and in the community to try to tailor the program to what people really want.
Okay.
So that's that one. And can you repeat the second one? I'm sorry.
The home repairs program.
Okay.
You know, just trying to understand the threshold, for it.
Yeah. I don't have that. Karen, do you know that off the top of your head? Yeah, I don't either. So we still do the program. One thing that the county funds part of that program and is for the supplies and our unmet needs funding that I was talking about, that is part of it that focuses on the actual one's materials. Bob, help me out here. And one's for the actual work.
One is materials, and one covers the actual services. The unmet needs money is what we use for the repair services. Yes.
So we continue to do it. There's always a waiting list. There's always a need. We refer most everything to INHS, and they determine if it meets the qualifications that we have in the contract. And it is, I want to say the AMI. Is that correct? It's something around there. But there is guidelines that that have to be met. I mean, 60 plus, I think it's 80% of the AMI. And there's a couple other things. We try to limit the scope of work. We don't want to spend $10,000 on one person and leave, not so many people meeting their needs also. So it's a constant back and forth with INHS. We do refer a lot of people from our office because we still do our falls prevention program. So we can identify some of the things that people might need. For example, we go into a home to identify slips and trips and falls. We can identify that somebody might need a raised toilet seat or a railing that goes down their hall. So we can take that program and like directly hook them up with INHS to get those things done for them to as a part of a falls prevention, but also as, to keep them safe in their home.
Thank you.
Did I answer all your questions?
I'll follow up with you.
Okay. Thank you.
Thank you.
Yes.
All right. Thank you. And as an aging person myself, I want to thank Lisa and Karen and Bob for their good work. Have a nice evening, and we'll be moving on to animal control and the FPCA. Thanks.
Thanks. Bye.
Thank you. Okay.
That's on page 5-2 of your books, people. And is that Jim Boudreaux there?
It sure is, yes. Hello, everybody. I'm coming to you live from my kitchen. Hope everyone is well.
Yeah. Hope you are too.
Yes, very much so. Shall I just begin, or do you need me to share the screen?
Yes, please. You can share your screen if you'd like.
Okay. Should be the same thing you guys have there, but... Okay. Here we go. And as promised, the past couple of years, it is populated with winners from our annual SPCA calendar contest for your viewing pleasure. But again, a very standard, and this was actually our calendar winner this year, a one-eyed little Jack Russell Terrier, which we all love. But obviously, we're not looking for any OTRs, standard for what we were sent. And I think everybody is aware that it's a critical program that provides both the New York State required rabies vaccination to populations of cats in our community, feral and free roaming being the two sort of ones that we're targeting the most of this program, as well as spay and neuter surgery, as well as the program itself in its entirety is providing spay and neuter surgeries for residents of Tompkins County with low income qualified either it be on forms of public assistance or just low income, there's a sliding scale for these surgeries. So the program, we did pretty well through the pandemic months. We, as you could imagine, we did not or were not able to close because we had animals in our care. We did suspend some services for a little while there, just to give you an idea. We moved everything to sort of by appointment only rather than, having the doors open to members of the public for the entire time. So there was definitely a reduction in animal service in 2020, as you can imagine, but we were still able to service 1,726 cats. That is actually down, it wasn't down a tremendous amount because we would sort of start up clinics again and then pause them as case load sort of increased. But it was only a decrease of 372 over 2019. So, not a tremendous, a large number, 370 some odd animals is a lot. But we were definitely worried going into it that we were going to be looking at more than that. But like I said, the clinics were sort of one of the things that we suspended almost immediately because, we're looking at 35 to 40, individuals showing up, weekly to the facility, and just to minimize risk, we didn't think that that was something we could continue with until we had plans in place to safely do that, which we came up with rather quickly. We 1,767 rabies vaccinations were administered, through the program last year, which again is down, it looks like about 260 wise from the year before that. So again, pretty good considering things. But again, with this program, the good thing about it is that we can obviously scale it to A, the amount of funding that we have, and B, the amount of available clinics that we have. So it is likely in 2022, because we're almost through 2021, we had some similar operational pauses in the beginning of 2021 as a result as well, just from safety and the numbers in our county increasing. And also from a staffing perspective, we have staff who was certainly willing to clean and do all sorts of things inside the building, but staff was a little bit more leery of working one-on-one with directly with members of the public. But we have plans for 2022 to likely typically we would do, 49 or 50 clinics throughout the year. We might add some additional ones in 2022 to sort of play a little catch up on the weekends here and there. Because demand has certainly increased. I mean, we are right now, for example, booking female cats out until, mid to late November. So we're usually not that far ahead. The biggest driver of that, honestly, is local veterinary practices are having the same issue with staffing and reopening and not taking as many clients per day as they maybe would have in the past. So people are struggling who are looking for this service to get into their own private veterinarians. So even from the, even in the past when it was more of an affordability issue, it's now become an accessibility issue too. So we're just sort of rolling with that. But like I said, demand for the program is actually up, and we might add some clinics this year to sort of accommodate that if the local veterinary community still struggles to get their stuff moving. Next.
That's some fancy chicken.
Yeah, it is a fancy. So there are some people out there who spend a lot of money on chickens and really enjoy some interesting breeds. But yeah, that's it's unusual that a non-cat or dog would make our calendar, but
it's a glamour chicken.
Yep. So that's sort of the program in a nutshell. Certainly I'm happy to answer any questions anybody might have, but like I said, all in all, despite everything, we got through it all, and it was a pretty successful year.
Well, your work is much appreciated. If you could stop sharing your screen so I can see if there are any hands up for questions. Amanda, he has a question.
I love the cats and dogs. Thank you. this maybe is a little bit off topic, but so the funding that you get from Tompkins County goes just to the cats. Do you get other funding for, because I know you do dogs spaying and neutering as well. Do you get other like state funding or something for that?
Yes, absolutely. And we use the funding from Tompkins County to support the entire spay and neuter program. We focus these funds specifically on, or we try and gear these county funds specifically towards our feral and free roaming population of cats in Tompkins County, mostly because they're the ones, two things. Number one, they're the ones who aren't really pets. They're the ones that are sort of, no one's taking responsibility for. So people are very unwilling to sort of take a feral cat to a private veterinarian and spend a few $100 to have it spayed or neutered. But they're the ones reproducing the most. You know, it's estimated, if you use general guidelines by like the ASPCA or, you know, there's some formulas you can do, but it's typically, formulaically said that, you know, there might be something like 17,000 free roaming cats in Tompkins County based on its land area and its people population. So targeting that specific segment is really important because they're the ones that are coming in. The 400 to 500 kittens that we see every year at the SPCA are typically not being born in people's homes. They're typically being born in the wild, and people are finding them and bringing to us either on their property or at a barn or, you know, any number of college town, you know, really any number of places where you might pick them up. So we try and, put these metrics in terms of cats because that's the, because there's an unwillingness of people to really pay for that service, we try and use these funds specifically for that. In addition to that, we obviously get, you know, people specifically geared donations locally to us specifically for spay and neuter. And we do get, we were concerned we weren't going to get it this year because of state funding issues, but the ASPCA administers the New York State Animal Population Control Program. And those are funds that are available statewide to shelters that help subsidize these programs at shelters as well. The only caveat with those dollars is that the person using them has to be on some sort of form of public assistance. So whether it be Medicare, Medicaid, disability, there's lots of programs that qualify, but they have to be on, they have to show proof of one of those programs. Whereas we have the other dollars that we might have, we don't require proof of a program. We just require them to, give a certain income, be below a certain income level. But again, going back to the state funding, you know, we were concerned about not getting it all. We actually did, our grant application was approved. It was probably about $15,000 less than the prior year. We didn't expect to get full funding based on budgets and all the other stuff, but that's still about $50,000 that, you know, goes towards this program from the, it's state dollars, but it's administered through the ASPCA.
Great, thank you.
Thank you. And now Annie usually has questions about culverts, electric vehicles, or cats, and I'm guessing this one's about cats.
Well, you are right this time, but well, there could be such a thing as electric cats, but that's maybe a song I'm remembering from the 80s. But anyway, so Jim, thanks. I just wanted to say thanks for all your programs. So as you see pictured here, this is four of our kittens that we fostered a couple of years ago, and two of them I convinced Deborah Dawson to take. We have one, and we found a home for the other one. And we were, you know, fortunate to be able to afford to get them spayed and neutered. They were found in a barn, but the program that we got them through is a trap neuter release program, and without the help of the SPCA to help spay and neuter the cats, it would be there'd be a lot of animals out there in really bad condition. So thank you for all you do.
My pleasure. I mean, and thank you for mentioning the TNR program. I mean, that we actually saw a dip in intake this year, not just through the program in terms of cat spay and neuters, but the largest segment of spay and neuters not being done, unfortunately, were TNRs. And that just goes back to the fact that, you know, during the, especially the beginning of the pandemic, under normal circumstances, if people were driving down the road, you know, and saw a litter of kittens or had, you know, some ferals on their property, they would take it upon themselves to contact us and get that work done. But obviously they were concerned. They had greater concerns during the pandemic, you know, one of the top being their own health and safety and all that other stuff. So, unfortunately, it's the segment that we saw the largest decrease in terms of coming into the shelter. And it's the one that sort of needs the most help. But the numbers are rebounding. So people are taking an active interest again in, helping to control the population and to get us those animals that need it.
Great. Thank you.
Thank you, Jim. Okay. I don't see any other questions. So, thanks again, Jim. Have a lovely evening.
My pleasure. Thank you guys so much.
You're welcome. And we'll move on now to the Health Department. That's on page 4-84 of your books. And our own Frank Krupa is probably going to have slides for us. Long time no see, Frank.
I know. And I got to say, it's a bit unfair that I have to follow Jim in the animal pictures. So I just want you to keep that in mind. All right. Let's see here. There we go. Sure. Are you seeing the full PowerPoint?
Yes, we are. Thank you.
Okay, thank you. We're starting with the health department budget. This should go relatively quick. It's high level. I think you guys know what we've been doing for the last year or so. So we're just going to kind of run through the numbers. Brenda Crosby, who I think you all know, is here with me, as well as Harmony Ayers Friedlander and Jeremy Porter. We are working together as one department now, so they're all here for the two presentations. So starting with the recommended budget, the one thing I just want to point out here is that essentially, except for the OTRs that are proposed, this is a maintenance of effort budget. There's a lot of movement of dollars coming into and out of our budget right now because of COVID. And so that's why you're seeing these large swings from 2021 to 2022. But I just want you to know that overall the budget is maintenance of effort outside of the OTRs that we'll run through. Our full-time equivalents, the change, five of the FTEs are related to OTRs, and we'll talk about those in a minute. The 0.2 we were able to absorb into our target budget, and it really was around retirements that we had that came up that allowed us to do a bit of reorganizing. So we converted a 0.8 community health nurse, a half of a public health sanitarian, and a half of a keyboard specialist into one full communications, public health communications coordinator, and one health educator. Really what it was a reorganization of our health promotions program, and we were able to absorb that 0.2. And the other five we'll talk about here in the OTRs. So starting off, our first OTR is a plan to continue our community health worker program, or what we were referring to as public health ambassadors. As you know, over the summer, we were able to leverage some Kresge funding to be able to bring on some community health workers to help get the word out about vaccinations in our hard-to-reach communities. And it was a rousing success. And the work that they were able to do was great. But I think probably more importantly, what we got from that was different experiences from different members of our community that have that could help inform the work that we were doing. So not only were they out there getting the word out about vaccines, but they were also helping us, you know, connect with communities that we might not have otherwise connected with. So we are proposing two full-time community health workers to continue that program moving forward. The second OTR is for a full-time public health sanitarian for our core services. So in environmental health, there's been significant increase in mandates over the last probably 5 years. Had COVID not happened, we would have been having this conversation probably 2 years ago. The state has continually added mandates to the public health work, everything from increased water standards around PFOAs and PFOS, lead and copper rule changes, cooling towers where we have new work to do there. It's just continued to increase the amount of demands on our environmental health staff, and we are at a tipping point where we're unable to keep up with the existing staffing. So this is actually something that's been building over a few years, but really we're at the point now where it was something we felt we needed to move forward with. The third OTR is increased hours in our admin support. So this is part of our reorganization as we merge the two departments together. We are reorganizing. We've had some retirements that have allowed us to adjust our job descriptions to be more in line with what we're asking folks to do. And this is really an effort to increase capacity in that group of people without needing to create new positions. So by increasing folks from 35 to 40 or 37 and a half to 40, we're adding capacity without needing to add full positions. And all the affected employees are aware that this has been proposed and are supportive of the additional hours. The fourth OTR is an administrative assistant, two, and that is a position for environmental health. So we shrunk environmental health as part of the 2021 budget. And so this is really a building back of that, to be able to support the staff in environmental health that are doing more work, including our proposal about to add another sanitarian. The fifth OTR is another public health sanitarian. This one is related to water resources. A couple of years ago, there was some conversation about some work around water resources in the lake and watershed that needed some attention. And our environmental health division agrees with that. Things like HABs, watershed regulations and such, there's a lot of work to be done there, and it's just not something we're able to absorb with all of the other core services that we're required to provide. So we are proposing to bring on another sanitarian to focus specifically on those water resource issues. Our sixth OTR here is rabies post-exposure treatment. And this we're shifting from target to rollover. We want to use our rollover for these funds because we're in a transition. When the urgent care when CMC closed the urgent care, they were our primary source for providing rabies post-exposures, both for the animal bite and for subsequent vaccines that are needed. And with that closing, we've had to shift that a bit. And the cost for doing that could potentially be larger. We're still working with the hospital, trying to find alternatives, but we wanted to make sure we have the appropriate resources available. And we do think by the end of next year, we'll have a program developed where we'll know the actual cost and can better better budget for that. So we're proposing to use rollover to help stem the tide until we get that all worked out. Continuing on, number seven, we're asking to use rollover for an update on the public health sanitary code and essentially bringing on a consultant to do that work. It's something the Board of Health and our environmental health staff have been wanting to do for several years. It is behind, and quite frankly, some of the changes in that sanitary code will also help address some of the water resource issues that we're talking about. So we'd like to bring on a consultant to be able to do kind of the legwork of reviewing and looking at what needs to be updated, with technical expertise being provided by our staff. So we're proposing to do that using our rollover again. The next OTR is for a mental health and public health integration meeting. We did this back in December of 2019, you may remember, right after the legislature voted to approve the merger. And it was a chance to physically bring all 130 so staff together and have a full day of getting to know each other, learning, developing our future and what we want our programming to be. And we'd really like to be able to do something similar to that again. So that would cover the cost of event space and the costs associated with that, and potentially bringing in speakers and or facilitators for that meeting. The ninth OTR here is our maternal and child health program. Our nursing team, in the midst of all of the COVID work they've been doing, it's hard to believe they had any time, but they've been looking to relaunch our maternal and child health program, which has been more commonly known as MOMS, our Medicaid Obstetrics Medicaid Services. We want to expand that to all moms. And they've built a program to be able to do that. They have the structure. And really, we need to do some outreach and advertising to get the word out on that. And so this is a one-time request from our rollover to be able to do that work. The 10th OTR here is, again, to use rollover. We've been talking with CSI, the group that does the HABS work. We have another contract with them to do HABS work. One of the things they've talked about wishing they had was a database for the HABS data, right? So to have a place that would be publicly available so folks could go see what was going on related to HABS in our county. And so, again, we're proposing to use rollover to contract with CSI to create that database. And then the last and I believe largest OTR is, again, to use rollover to finish our fleet replacement with electric vehicles. We have 6 vehicles left that need to be converted over. They are 12 and 14 years old, I believe, the gas vehicles we're driving. 2 of them were able to leverage through the county's project to electrify the fleet. But that leaves 4 additional vehicles, and we'd like to use rollover to purchase those last 4 vehicles, which would completely electrify our fleet. And that is it for slides.
Thank you, Frank. Do we have questions for Frank? Lisa?
I just wanted to make one comment, and I think it may have been an error on admin's part coming to Frank. On the slides, the public health, the second sanitarian was requested as target and recommended as one time, as it's a new initiative. So I believe I informed you of that, but when we sent the slide deck out, it may have contained that error that it said that it was recommended as target. In the budget book, it says it's recommended as one time. That's all.
Yes. Yeah, I agree. Sorry about that mistake. And I'm also now noticing that the REACH OTR is not on the slide deck.
That's under mental health, I think, for REACH.
Yeah, I think it is.
Okay. Yeah. Okay. Sorry about that.
Okay. Martha?
Thank you, Deborah. Thank you, Frank and team. So many moving parts in this department. I'm glad to see the public health sanitarium for water resources and the focus on HABs. As you probably know, we've been asked to increase our dues significantly to the intermunicipal organization because they're looking to hire somebody for the whole Cougar Lake watershed. And those dues would support that professionalization of the organization. How would, assuming they get the dues approved from all the counties, how would this position be different from what they're going to do? Do you have any, maybe you don't know what they're going to do, but.
Yeah, I'm not 100% sure what they're going to do. I think, you know, the HABs work is pretty significant in and of itself. But we very much want to be looking at the entire watershed within the county, to make sure that, you know, we're involved in those conversations that are happening, that the county's represented, and that we have, you know, dedicated staff to address those types of issues. It just with our core public health services that the rest of environmental health is doing, every time these new things come up that we all really want to spend time on, there just isn't. And so this is a proposal to kind of create that time for those water resource issues.
Okay, thank you. And since you're using a lot of rollover, and I go over to the rollover page and you're really getting, you had a lot and you're really getting it down to, I guess, 16,000 is left. Did we get clarity on that issue of whether the savings from staffing, when you had a number of people on your staff whose salaries got covered by, I guess it was FEMA money, did we clarify that whether that really was legitimately rollover or not?
Yeah. We did, and it's revenue, right? So we get revenue, all staff generate revenue in some form or fashion. And so that revenue coming into the department is part of the rollover calculation. My understanding is that the cost of salary, if there was savings from not filling a position or something to that effect, is what gets subtracted out of rollover calculations. So the way that it was explained to me is that these are revenues coming in, and all revenues are part of that rollover calculation minus what gets held out based on the very specific line items for salary and fringe.
I see Lisa wants to say something, but I guess I thought that revenue was all salary.
Sorry, Frank. I can speak to it a little bit too because I circled back with Rick on his revenue calculation. And he said that the savings from personal services and fringe were already deducted from the rollover. So in his estimation, it was calculated correctly, and he kind of shared the math. So that those, what you're speaking to, Martha, was already deducted from the rollover.
Okay. All right. So that was a lot of revenue then. Okay. All right. Thank you very much. That's good to know.
Yeah, thank you. And Frank, further to Martha's original point, I think that the watershed manager that the intermunicipal organization is looking to hire would probably have a broader scope of interest than your public sanitarian. But I would hope that if and when the IO can finally hire that person, that they will work closely with your department and with the soil and water conservation district staff, because we can leverage quite a lot of attention if we all cooperate. So thank you. Are we ready to move on to mental health? I don't see any more questions for Frank on health. Okay, so who is going to be addressing the mental health budget?
Me again.
Oh, you again. Okay. Well, at least you're really good at sharing your screen, right?
Well, Dominic's taught me well. We spent a lot of time.
Yeah, lots of practice.
All right. So I'm going to take a similar approach here with the mental health budget. Here is our overall budget. You can see the impacts here. There's roughly a $1.2 million adjustment. About 700,000 of that is related to OTRs. About 200,000 of that is an increase in estimated revenues. And about 300,000 is a writing of state aid related to what used to be part of our health home program. Had to be a portion of those services were contracted out. And so last year that was not yet in place. And so this year those dollars are there, but they're also being spent accordingly. So generally speaking, outside of the OTRs, this is also a maintenance of effort budget. So our full-time equivalents. So from 2021 to 2022 in the budget, you see there's a half FTE reduction. How that's accounted for is we had a psychiatrist who used to be on staff who is now contracted and providing telemedicine services for us. So the money shifted from a salary and fringe line to a professional services line. So it's not really a change in service. It's just a change in how we are paying for those services. And then there are three positions within our OTRs. One is our wellness court coordinator, and then two of them are peers within our PROS program. And I'll talk a bit more about that here in the OTRs. So starting off, our first priority here is one-time ARPA funding, and this is for our wellness court resource coordinator. This is the position that we are hoping OCA will take over. It is vital to the wellness court operating, which is why it is our top priority OTR. We are keeping it as one time because we don't want OCA thinking we can afford to pay for it, right? This really needs to be a position that fits within the Office of Court Administration, and we continue through Judge Miller to advocate with them for that, but we know the court has been successful and we want to continue to fund the position while we advocate for regular funding from OCA. I will tell you, we have applied for a federal grant that would cover part of this position and our sixth OTR that I'll talk about in a minute. So I want you to know we are trying every avenue possible to find other sources of funding for this, but right now, we want to ensure we can maintain the program. So that is our first OTR. Our second is the only real target OTR, and this is $10,000 for our crisis team pay. You may remember a few months ago, I was telling you that we were struggling to staff our mobile crisis team because when we built the program, we were not expecting the demand on services that we currently have and have seen pretty consistently. The cost to increase pay for participation was significantly more than this, but the $10,000 was just the bit we couldn't find in target. So we're asking to increase target to make sure we can cover those costs ongoing. The next one is a big one, and this is a request from the Alcohol and Drug Council, and it's related to their facility that they're opening up in Lansing by the mall. You may remember they've received large amounts of money from the state for the capital project and to eventually operating costs once they're up and running. Where they are at is they're in this startup phase, right, where when you're not going to go from zero clients to a full book of clients at full capacity, but yet you have to be staffed as such for your licensure. And so this is an opportunity to kind of get them a kickstart. It is proposed over 3 years to decrease and then ultimately after decrease each year. And then at that 3 year mark, we would hope that they would be sustainable and the request would not follow. You know, maybe there will be, I don't know, but the way that we designed this was as a decreasing contribution to help them get started over the next 3 year period. The next OTR is for the peer support specialists, which are the two FTEs that I mentioned earlier. Our PROS program, our Personalized Recovery Oriented Services program, has been wanting to engage peers for quite some time. And they're at a point now where they actually have some folks that are participating in the program that feel like they want to become peers and be part of the program from that perspective. So we wanted to come and look for some support to be able to start that program up with some peers from the program. We put a work group together to kind of talk about the best way to do that and how we would fund them and to make sure that we're paying them appropriately and all the things that go along with peers, because we want to treat them well. But we're really right now targeting people that are currently in the program that want to kind of advance their support and their work and become a peer support. The next OTR, this is a kind of a request that came from staff at Mental Health in preparation for the ongoing issues with COVID that people are facing, not only for the clinicians to build skills to help the people they serve, but also to help themselves as they're dealing with this new trauma that people are facing, how to deal with it personally, how to adjust their treatment methodologies. So there's a kind of a menu of trainings that we've proposed that we think with this $30,000 investment would really give our staff some good support and tools for both themselves and the folks that they're serving. And then I believe our last OTR, no, it's not, second to last, is the Wellness Court Case Manager. So this is a request that came in from Judge Miller and the folks working in the Wellness Court. As they're looking to expand to the program countywide, what we've found out is that Michelle, our Court Resource Coordinator, she's doing a lot, and it's really more than one person can do. And so she's going to be focusing on the court component of it, but she's spending a lot of time doing some of that case management work. She's spending a lot of time doing that case management work, which makes it hard to think about expanding more people into the program. So they really think it's important at this phase in the growth of the court to have that wellness court case manager. This is something that Reach Medical has been partnering with the court on, and they feel like for this funding, they would be able to provide that level of support to the court. This position would be fully funded in the federal grant that we applied for. So again, we want to do this. We think it's important. We'd like to get it up and operational, but we are continuing to try to find other resources to fund the court, particularly long term. And then the last OTR is another Reach request, and this one really is related to COVID response. So I think you all are aware that Reach was our COVID response arm with our homeless and hard to reach populations. They went out and did testing in the encampments. They stood up telemedicine in the encampments. They took vaccines to the encampments and set up clinics throughout downtown in places where we could reach our homeless population. They incurred a deficit in order to support us doing that. This OTR is one-time ARPA to supplement some of that deficit that they incurred and in order to help them continue to keep doing that work that we need them to do from a COVID perspective as we go forward. So this really is a recognition of the deficit that was created by helping us last year and a reaction to continued need as we move forward. That
is it. All right, everyone. Does anyone have any questions for Frank on this presentation? Martha.
Thank you very much. This is really informative. On the Reach Medical, the $202,000, is that for just for 1 year, or is that meant to be more than 1 year?
No, that's one year.
1 year. And the, you've got the two positions on the wellness court. Are you hoping that OCA will pay for both of those?
Yeah, at some point, we're hopeful that there will be funding for the entirety of the court. We're being realistic that getting one has been challenging. So we are continuing, as I said, looking for other funding sources to try to offset some of this. But really, the court has been so super successful that the dollars that we're investing here are paying off in so many ways that I would encourage that this is a small investment for a really big return.
All right. Well, maybe I'll talk offline about what kind of advocating you're doing. We worked with Judge Miller on the third county court, so maybe I can make some connections too. All right. Thanks very much, Frank.
Thank you.
Thank you. Annie?
Did I miss the part about electric cars for that?
Yeah, I think you did. And no cats on this one either.
No cats or electric cars? Okay. They must have some cars, right? Vehicles?
Yeah. We actually have 5 Bolts at Mental Health that we've had for a while.
Bolts with a V?
With a V, yes. So
with a V, okay. They're the better ones, yeah.
Yeah, they're the gas hybrid plug-in. They're getting old, right? We've had those for a while. We've had those longer than any of the electric ones at the health department. And we still have gas cars in the mental health fleet, but they're aged out. We just haven't aged them out yet. Without the health homes program, there's less of a demand for vehicles at the mental health department. So as those Bolts phase out, we'll probably not be replacing all of them either.
Okay, thank you.
Anything else? Frank, I appreciate the fact that you're looking for other funding sources for the wellness court positions, and I'm hoping that we are not, by approving OTRs for the wellness court and the Alcohol and Drug Council and Reach Medical, I'm hoping that we're not creating another 3 long-term dependencies on county funding. It's very easy to help people out for a year or two, but, you know, I don't want people to be dependent on that funding if there are other sources available. It's awfully hard to wean people off once they get used to getting support from the county. So I do appreciate you being proactive about that.
Yes, and we've been clear with both Reach and the Drug Council in our conversations that, particularly with Reach right now, it is a one-time thing associated with a COVID response. And quite frankly, they stepped up and did some amazing things that otherwise we would not have been able to do. And I think we need to recognize that. But we were clear. There were other requests that did not, make their way all the way through the process because they were of a different type. And as far as the Alcohol and Drug Council, we've been clear that these are related to startup. You know, we know that there's costs in the early days, and we are actively weaning them off of this just on the way we built the OTR over the 3 years. So yes, we're with you, and we've been communicating that as well. The Wellness Court that one's a little harder because it is just doing amazing things, and it's OCA that we're battling with, and you guys know what that means. And so we will continue to try to find other funding through grants and others as we can. But that one's just a little bit harder because of the situation.
Well, I understand. And I don't mean to in any way underestimate the value of the contributions that these organizations make. And I know particularly that Reach Medical was on the ground in places that no one else wanted to visit in order to minister to folks who were most at risk for COVID. And we do appreciate that. I'm sorry, I can't hear you, ma'am.
Dr. Walden, CEO of Reach Medical.
Yeah.
I just want to, so that that we understand it's one-time funding, I also want for the legislature to understand that we're still doing lots of ongoing work, especially in the encampments as the second round of COVID has come up. And so the amount of need that we're sort of addressing that, as you said, no one else is able to address, that we have this expertise, I would love to be recognized by the legislator as COVID sort of continues, hepatitis A continues, well, actually it's under control, but these are the sorts of things that public health needs that are we're facing. Also, with our involvement with the wellness court, the case management in that position, we're looking to make it to train them, certify them as a CERPA, which would relieve some of the cost for the county because they can bill for services. So I just wanted to give that added point. Thank you.
That's very helpful, and it's nice to finally put a face to the name. I've heard a lot about your good work, and we do appreciate it. No, that's fine. It's good to have the clarification. Does anybody have anything else on this particular topic, or are we ready to move on? Okay. Thank you, Frank.
Thank you.
Thank you for everyone from the mental health and public health team, and thank you, Dr. Waldman. Bye. Okay. Moving on. Now on Tompkins Community Action, which is on page 5-31 of your book, and I don't know who's here from Tompkins Community Action to make a presentation, but Danielle.
Hi, I'm Danielle Harrington from Tompkins Community Action. I'm here. Do I just jump right in with my screen share?
Yes, ma'am, you do. Nice to meet you, Danielle.
Yes, thanks for having me. So real quickly, I'm not launching into a huge department update. This is our mission statement. We're an anti-poverty organization that serves all of Tompkins County through a Head Start housing and food services. And we are simply here to ask for an increase to restore to a funding amount from 2021. Yes.
Danielle, your slides aren't progressing. You're still in the first one.
So oh, thank you for telling me that.
Oh, you're welcome.
Oh, geez.
It happens. A year and a half in, we're still not used to this.
I know. Let's see.
And you're not in presentation mode.
Okay.
We can look in our books, can't we?
Yeah, if you want to, we can look in our books.
Yeah,
we have all the information, and you've got one OTR.
Yeah, okay.
Let's just do that.
All right. There. Okay, now I can see your faces. Okay, tech is on my training list. Anyway, I just stuck to the budget slides anyway. A couple of pictures, but no need. So we are asking just to have a restoration to a 12% cut from 2021. The amount is $30,918. And these are funds that we use as federal match in our grants for supportive housing and Head Start, early Head Start funding. During COVID, we were able to get a waiver for this local match. So during last year, the 12% cut was not a problem. This year, the federal Head Start grant is not allowing any waivers of any kind, and we need to come up with our full non-federal share match. We use these county dollars for that, and that is why we are here asking for that restoration.
Well, that seems perfectly reasonable to me. Does anybody have any questions about this? Doesn't seem that anyone does, Danielle, so you're off the hook.
Well, I will be sure to practice my screen sharing skills should we be on Zoom next year. But thank you so much, and I'm sorry for that. I'm sorry for this. Have a great night.
You too. All right. So that leaves us with Youth Services and the Youth Services Recreation Board. Is Kate here?
Yes, ma'am, I am. Hello,
yes,
how are you?
Is.
Hi.
Pretty good, how are you?
I'm doing okay. I'm also joined with Teresa Albert tonight. She's going to help me with the youth services budget, and then I'm going to do a really quick sort of overview of the rec partnership with 1OTR after that's over. So
okay.
I will share my screen. I think I'm already in presentation mode, so I'm hoping. Can you guys see that?
Yes.
All right. Okay, so you already know who we are and why we're here and what year it is. Teresa, I'm going to hand it over to you and let you do the first couple slides.
Okay. Good evening. Looking at our 2022 budget, it is pretty much steady from our 2021 budget. It maintains all the same levels. Our department is broken down basically into three categories: our planning and coordination, our agencies, and municipalities. So pretty much across the board, it maintains the same level of funding from 21 going into 22. The increase in the target is attributed to the increase in the fringe rate. So that's why that increased. On the revenue side, why it's lower is for 5 years, we were receiving a Safe Harbor commercial sexual exploited children's grant. That was only for 5 years. 2021 is the last year. So that's why our revenue, it looks lower going 22, because that grant is no longer. We are anticipating that our state aid will stay flat going into 22 as well. And looking at the full-time FTEs, we are maintaining 4 full-time staff. When COVID started in 2020, we did, when we had, our department had to take some cuts, we did lose 1 staff member. They decided to retire, and we did have to cut 1 other position to cover those cuts. Early this year, we were able to hire a full-time position and to bring us up to 4. So most of 2020, we ran the department part of 21 with just 3 staff. We took that time to look at how we were running things, and we did some reorganization and reshifting of some responsibilities and the way we were working with agencies and municipalities. And we're happy that going into 2022, we will maintain our 4 full-time staff.
Okay, awesome, Teresa. Thank you. I'll finish up for us here. I get the pleasure of doing the over-target slides for you guys. We've got 5 of them. Teresa did a really good job of kind of setting us up for some of these, so I'll spend the most time on the second one. The first one, that full-time person that we hired in the February of 2021 for the coordinator of community youth services. To maintain that 12% reduction in our budget, we brought her in at the higher rate, which is what the county does, and then 9 months later, you're moved to the working rate. What this $6,569 is representative of is the combination of fringe and salary that make up the difference between that working and fringe rate. And so that's what that is, so that we'll bring her up to the appropriate levels now that she's been with us for that amount of time. The second OTR deals with our runaway and homeless youth system. You've probably heard me talk a lot about this over the last few months. So I'm going to spend just a little bit extra time to give you guys a little bit of background on this, because it is our largest OTR. Youth homelessness is not new to Tompkins County. Over the last year, specifically since the fall of 2020, we've seen a drastic increase in the number of youth that are needing these type of services and supportive services. Unfortunately, in December of 2020, Family and Children's, who operated their Open Doors program, made the decision due to some capacity issues around COVID-19 with staffing and financial that they were closing down that program. The Open Doors program focused on youth, runaway homeless youth that were either at homeless or at risk of experiencing homelessness ages 12 to 17. The ideology of this program model was it's preventative in nature. So what it did, this program recruited and licensed host homes. They did intensive case management with youth and their families. They also provided a 24/7, 365 days a year hotline. So they were dealing with youth at all hours of the day, on Christmas, the day after, really making sure that they were available to the youth who were in crisis. And so the closing of this program has left a huge gap in the services, and particularly for low-income homeless youth, and particularly that younger population, that 12 to 17-year-old. Something that's important to kind of understand about this particular demographic is that when you talk about youth homelessness, a lot of times for this particular age group looks like couch surfing. Oftentimes they are housed. If they leave the house, they don't have a place to go. They're staying with a friend or a family member, and it's that generosity that really keeps them off the street. And that's great. However, the important thing to remember is that without the intensive case management that is provided with an organization like Open Doors, the actual underlying issues that are putting that risk at youth of homelessness are not being addressed. The actual ability to couch surf, though, has been really, really impacted by the COVID-19 pandemic. One, because of the financial issues, right? Maybe someone was staying with their friend Johnny's family. Johnny's parents have lost their jobs, and so they can no longer afford to have him stay with them. And also this particular age group was the last to be eligible, right, for the COVID vaccine. So there were some health issues that were in part of that. There were some financial issues, low socioeconomic youth, BIPOC, youth of color, are so much more disproportionately impacted by this problem. As we knew this was an issue, we had several conversations with several of our community partners around Tompkins County trying to find a home over the last few months for this program to sit in a new organization. But due to the fact that a lot of those were having capacity issues with staffing already and funding issues, they really didn't feel that it was right for them to do that. And the larger component of that was that at that point in time, the amount of money that we had to put on the table to fund what would have been the whole program was just not adequate. And that was the end result of every conversation that we had with for-profits and even a nonprofit or a for-profit organization that we had a conversation with in Tompkins County. So with all of that said, we really kind of went back to the drawing board and we're trying to understand what the needs of these particular youth were in our community. And so on June 7th, we ended up hosting a community conversation virtually through the Zoom platform. This particular community conversation was again focused on those 12 to 17 year olds. It was attended by 40 individuals that represented 20 of our local community partners. It did not take long for us to understand that the housing crisis for them is a major issue, and it really had become its own pandemic of sorts, right? There's really no, without a youth shelter, without a place to put them, we just did not have any response at this point for them. And a lot of nonprofits that were not necessarily in the housing field prior to this stepped in and were fielding calls 24/7 from youth, their families, other agencies that were referring, and even law enforcement in some cases asking them to help. And so stepping up and trying to do the absolute best that they could. And so really what it came down to, in speaking with our youth advisory board, the $73,000, which is I know is, you know, people see that and they think, oh, that's a lot of money, but the truth is it's just not enough to fund what we were looking to do with this. And so this over target request that we're doing now is really this $80,000 would be added to that $73,000. So that brings the total up to about $153,000. $18,000 of that is going to be state aid, which we anticipate will stay the same for the next year. And then understanding that the agency that we partner with has to do a 15% match. And in talks with Family and Children's and some past people who have operated this program historically, this is the type of ballpark, the minimum sort of ballpark budget, annual budget that it's really going to take to have two staff that are going to be able to fund those, going to be able to intensive case management, are going to be able to do that 24/7, 365 hotline, you know, be able to recruit, facilitate the conversations, and support the host home families, and then also do the reunification tools, which we know have become a really big issue for us as far as, you know, youth coming out of sort of, we've been calling it sort of the shadows of COVID, but really seeing that a lot of things that we would have been able to see over the last 18 months had those youth been in school, they've sort of been in the shadows and now they're coming out. In the last 24 hours, we've received emails and phone calls from three separate families asking for services around this topic. And we know that has been astronomically higher over the last few months, in just in talks with our community partners. So we're really hoping that this OTR will allow us to set it on an RFP and get this program back up and running and be able to help with that, this major need in our community. So the third OTR that we have here is $17,479, and it is around support for the municipal service system. Last year, kind of like Danielle was saying, we had the 12% reduction that we had to pass on to our agencies and municipalities, and that included our rural youth service program out of CCE. And so this $17,479 is divided into two parts. The first part of that, just a little over $15,300, makes up that 12% that CCE's coordinator and assistant coordinator budget were cut last year. This budget supports 8 planning groups, 14 municipalities, 6 school districts, and over 200 youth annually. Last year, they were able to, they had a new assistant coordinator that they hired. They cut several budget lines down. And they had some one-time reserves that they were able to use to sort of float that 12% reduction for the first year. However, this year they could not sustain that without doing a drastic cut in salaries and hours. And we feel that this is such an important part of the oversight and the operations of the MYSS system, that we want to make sure that that is restored so they can make sure to do the wonderful youth development they're doing in the rural communities, you know, and making sure that we're bringing the best to our rural youth. Minnetonka's County. Second part of this deals with the town of Danby. As far as the rural youth services managers, this particular position is the only one that's at 35 hours. The rest are at 40. And so they recently had a really young, wonderful young woman who worked for them who took another job with another youth serving agency here in Tompkins County because she was able to make some more money. And so this additional 5 hours, the cost of this is in total about $4,300. We're recommending that the county split that with the town of Danby. So about $2,149 is about half of that. So the town said that they would match the other half. This allows them to have someone that will be able to be on not just youth development, but also be involved in some of the other, things that happen that bring in families and make sure that they're strengthening those connections so that youth, as they're coming up through the system, will be able to see a familiar face, whether that's at a festival, whether that's at the school, whether that's out doing other family events. I feel like that's really important for them to be able to have that. The fourth OTR that we've got here is $10,000, and it's for the commercial sexual exploitation of children. As Teresa mentioned, in 2015, we were lucky to receive this grant from the New York State Office of Family and Children's Services through their Safe Harbor grant. We've done that for 5 years. Our Deputy Director, Bridget Nugent, also serves as a CSEC coordinator for the county. Just to kind of let you guys know what has happened, sort of what we've been able to do with this funds, we've coordinated a critical team that involves DSS, probation, the Advocacy Center, law enforcement, and other youth-serving agencies. We've developed a uniform CSEC screening tool that's been used to identify and connect over 30 Tompkins County youth at high risk or victims of CSEC with supportive services. Over the past 6 years, we have successfully trained over 300 professionals and community members on all the topics of CSEC through small workshops and large conferences, both virtually and in person. And so now that we have done this, we have turned into what they consider a graduated county. And so we are now trying to utilize local funds to support the awareness and provide training to key stakeholders around the issues of CSEC. The allocated funds would support training expenses and awareness campaign in addition to ongoing coordination for the CSEC critical team that Bridget does for us. The last OTR that we have here is $6,000, and we're asking to use rollover funds for this. This is for our municipal youth service system. We have about 50 volunteers that volunteer for 8 different youth commissions or community councils. They are dedicated individuals that attend numerous meetings, and they're dedicated to the youth in their communities. We have some people that have served 25 years plus to some that are brand new this year. These funds will allow us to bring the members of these commissions and community councils together, as well as elected officials and program providers. We want to have a time for them to learn from each other and to network, to hear about best practices in other municipalities, the ideas that will help inspire and motivate them, and just a chance for us to say thank you and really rejuvenate them so when they go back to their own groups of people, they'll be able to hit the ground running with some new energy You may think this looks a little bit familiar. We had originally planned to do this in the fall of 2020, but then COVID hit, so we postponed and ended up having to cancel the event. And so after 18 months of the COVID pandemic, we feel that this time of networking and collaboration is more important than ever. So we plan to do that very quickly. And with the addition of our new community coordinator of community youth services, we feel that she's been making great strides in helping the youth service department reach out, connect with these community councils and youth commissions. And we're excited about the prospect of that. And I think that is all we have for the youth services. Do we want to stop any questions now, or would you like me to go on to the REC partnership?
Does anybody have any questions right now? I can't see the folks who are on Zoom. So if anybody has a question, just sing out.
I do. It's Shauna.
Hi,
Kate and Teresa. Thanks for presenting tonight. I was wondering, I know that the Human Services Coalition received a $1.9 million grant for homeless youth and was wondering if some of this funding could be used to pay for that $80,000 of salary.
Great question. We anticipated that one was coming. So it's important to remember that when we're dealing with the homeless youth, that within that we're talking 12 to 24 years of age, right? So within that are a lot of different subsets of populations, right? This particular $80,000 really focuses on this 12 to 17 years of age right now. And it's preventative in nature. So it really goes sort of under and deals with some of those issues that are going to be causing the homelessness. The YHDP grant is a demonstration grant. So we just received a little over $2 million and really excited about that. But there is a planning phase that goes through that. We just had our first meeting with them this morning, with HUD, with the representation and the different people that are going to be providing technical assistance. There's a 6-month planning series. We have to submit those to HUD to make sure that we've demonstrated the need. We have to figure out how we want to put those projects together that would specifically meet the needs of our community. There are several layers of restrictions on how those funds can be used. So, for example, you cannot use these funds to build a youth shelter, right? And so the way that it works, these two sources of revenue are going to work in tandem and they're going to benefit one another, but the immediate result and focusing and being able to get into the schools with this $80,000 that would expand our RHY reach at this point is really geared toward a specific set that I think is really important. And so there may be some overlap, but not a whole lot. And understanding that it's only renewable for so many years and we're really trying to build a continuum of care that really addresses this as early as possible. Also keeping in mind that if you've got a youth who is, 13 or 14, even if you can do a drop-in shelter and have the services, you can't exactly put them in the same place with like a 21-year-old, right? Because you've got different restrictions and whatnot. So being able to have the host home model and being able to give these kids respite is a really important piece. I think that it's not an answer for everything, but it really does give a specific case example and an outlet for some of these youth. It really gives us a chance to reunify them and hopefully prevent them from actually needing to utilize these services in the future. Does that make sense?
Yeah, I mean, I guess I just don't want to duplicate services, and we haven't even started down this grant path yet to see what we're eligible for. And so, I guess I'm apprehensive to put, $1.9 million plus another $80,000 of county funds into something that would be brand new without seeing really what the need is after the $1.9 million.
Yeah, the thing that I can tell you, Shauna, is that, like I said, in 2019, the number of youth that actually utilized the host homes was fairly small in retrospect when you're looking at the total number of youth that the Open Doors program actually helped. And the reason for that was those intensive case management, right? And so to be able to get in and do these things and meet these kids where they are and give those the families and the youth the respite and then be the unification tools and the communication tools and address some of those underlying issues was really key. And so that gap of service that resulted from Open Doors it's really a housing crisis. It's a housing crisis for these youth. And so given the fact that we have a community partner that we've been talking to and ready to hit the ground running in 2022, especially when you look at COVID and all of the social, emotional, and mental issues that are coming, you know, having a provider and that is able to do that and focus in on that and able to help that initially as soon as possible, I think is going to be very, very important because we have seen the uptick already started, and I think it's going to be a lot worse. You know, and we've gone so, even though Open Doors did not close until 2020, at the end of 2020, they weren't fully operational for several months before that. They were mostly, you know, host homes didn't feel comfortable having people in their homes at that point. So there really was no respite. And they were doing most things virtual on the phone as well as they could, right? But it really is a need that is pressing. And I don't think that, you know, it's something that I'm excited about the YHCP grant, and I think it's going to be really important. But I think if we wait another 6 months, we're really going to be in a hurting place. And so making this move now, and then being able to make sure that we have something in place that we can use and build off of that work in tandem is, I think, positioning us in a really good place to be able to help those youth and their families in the immediate.
Thank you.
We're the vulnerable kids. You're only
saving anyone else?
Before it's young kids. Because it takes a dollar to spend on a youth.
I think your mic's on.
$100,000.
Who's speaking, please?
Glenn Morey. He wasn't muted.
Who?
It was Glenn Morey.
Okay. Glenn?
Yes.
Did you have a question?
No.
Oh, okay. All right. So let's move on to the Recreation Partnership.
It looks like maybe Martha has a question.
Yeah, thanks. It's a really quick one. So this 80,000 to put together with the 73. This would be a, so you had 20 organizations kind of express an interest in this issue. So you think there will be a number of applicants through the RFP process?
So we have some contingency plans in place, and we've been talking with, we've had conversations with Learning Web, you know, the Village of Ithaca, and then also Family and Children's. Part of the research that I did for this, Martha, was to actually reach out to some of those host home, people who had decided to do this and had conversations. And it was doubly heartbreaking because we know that this is a housing crisis, but then to also hear about the professionalism and how good Mike Ellis and his staff were, the loss of that service, really, I mean, it just breaks your heart. And so we've been in conversations with Family and Children's, ready to go with this, hopefully, because we have a contract with them. They're already approved, through OCFS, at least for the interim to look at this and really have worked with them on creating the budget and looking at what the actual cost of this program is, keeping in mind that they're the third organizations that have run this program and really all run into the fact that the money we were putting on the table, even with their match, was just simply not enough.
Do you think they would apply then?
Yeah, absolutely. Yes. Their board has already voted at this point to move forward with this if we get this funding. You know, and obviously we have to talk to the board and there's some other things that we need to clarify with that, but we've got some contingency plans in place to move on this as quick as possible because we really do think this is a housing crisis. It's only going to get worse.
Okay. Thank you very much.
Yeah.
Okay. Anyone else? Okay, Kate, why don't you go ahead with the Recreation Partnership then? Thank you.
Sure. Yep. Expenditures on this one. So the Rec Partnership has been in existence for 30 years. It's an intermunicipal contract that is one of a kind, and it really is built on the cornerstone of the town of Ithaca, the city of Ithaca, and county pays 25% respectively of all the fees that aren't counted for program fees and additional revenue sources that come in. And the last quarter is spent on, is divided up among the smaller municipalities, that exist of Caroline, Danby, Enfield, Dryden, Groton, Ulysses, Newfield, and the Village of Lansing. There's a formula that's used that uses assessed property value and a 3-year average of participants over the last year to really determine what the budget will be. And so, given the fact that they looked at 2020, and obviously we were able to keep the level funding for them moving into 2021, they did operate. So you see a 6.85%. This is the board got together and decided to do what they're considering a maintenance of effort. Because of all the restrictions that happened during the summer months because of COVID, and they were ever changing, and this is the contract of services done with the IFCA Youth Bureau, they made the decision to swap out some programs that typically aren't rec partnership programs because, for example, they couldn't do tackle football. So they put in things like flag football. They added things like sailing, right, which is not necessarily something that's typically in there. They did tennis lessons. They added skating and some other things. Which is great in the sense that those was a sort of an injection into programs that the youth who participate in the rec partnership don't typically get access to. But those programs are a little bit more expensive because they're smaller groups, right, and one-on-one, and really you're looking for a person who is trained in sailing or trained in tennis. So it's a little bit different than what rec partnership typically includes. And so what they said, what the rec partnership said, is that they want to keep the same level of programming with those new programs they did in 2021. They want to make sure they move those into 2022. And so at that cost, it's about a 6.85% increase. The difference between the two budgets, as you can see here, is about $20,000. So the OTR for us here is really, it's really 25% of that, which is the $5,026. And this is based on the collaboration works when each partnership sort of holds their weight. And we talked last year about if you pulled out $8,000 for the county and then every other partner pulls out $8,000, that $8,000 quickly becomes $32,000. And so we have got word from the city and the town and the smaller municipalities that they have all committed to this. And so our section of this would be about the $5,000 mark to make sure to keep this afloat and being able to do the same level of services for our for our folks that participate in these programs. So that is it for rec partnership.
Well, that was fast. Could you stop sharing your screen, please?
I will absolutely stop sharing my screen.
Okay, thanks. All right. Does anybody have any more questions for Kate? It doesn't look like it. Oh, wait, Leslyn does.
Hi, Leslyn.
I'm sorry, AJ. I was trying to get my cursor to work here. Kate, I was trying to follow what you were saying about the homeless youth piece of it. I got lost somewhere in the middle around the village of Ithaca and something else. So could you just give me the Cliff Notes version of what it is you all are trying to do?
So basically when Open Doors closed, right. The reason that they closed is the $73,000 was not enough to substantiate the whole program. And so what we did, and we knew this was an issue, we talked to the Advocacy Center, we talked to Learning Web, we talked to, we talked to DSS, we also talked to Glove House, which is a for-profit organization that partners with DSS to do some respite care. Here in Hopkins County. And all of those conversations ended with, it's not enough money to run a program of this sort, because you're talking 24/7 access to staff. You've got the crisis hotline. You've got the intensive case management. And plus you've got to recruit the host home, certify them, and make sure that you're doing a handoff with the staff or the staff to the youth, which could happen at any time. And so we went back and looked at prior budgets that people had submitted. There were three other organizations that had run this program previously. And it really brings the local funding to about $135,000. So we're looking, so it does restore about the $10,000 that we lost from the 12% in 2020, and then brings that up to a level that when you consider the $18,000 in state funding, which will come in the 15% match of the agencies, really brings you up to a budget of about $170,000, which is on par with what the actual cost of this program is. The point of the other agencies is that we had talked to them trying to find a home to see if someone else could do this, do a version of this, do something that would make sure that we could have a place to put these youth. Because without a shelter and without crisis housing, without the host home model at this point, we don't have any place to put them. And so, this has been a desperate thing for the last few months. And so while we're excited about the YHTP funding, And that's great and it's an amazing thing. That's still some months away before we're going to see that. And then even RFPs when we can hit the ground running. And so I think that we need to move quickly on this, to address that. So.
Okay. Thank you.
Yeah.
Okay. Anything else? Anyone else? All right. I think we're done. Thank you, Kate. And thank you, Teresa, being a silent watcher. All right. If there's nothing else, I think we are finished tonight. So everyone have a lovely evening, and we will see you Monday.
Thanks.
Good night, folks.
Good night, everybody.